Welcome to Stories from the Shadows. I'm Mardell. Here is part two of The Curse of the Catafalques by F. Anstey. The opportunity came after dinner that evening, when we were all in the drawing room, Lady Catafalque dozing uneasily in her armchair behind a fire screen, and Clorinde in the further room, playing funeral dirges in the darkness and pressing the stiff keys of the old piano with a languid, uncertain touch. Drawing a chair up to Sir Paul's, I began to broach the subject, calmly and temperately. "I find," I said, "that we have not quite understood one another over this affair in the Grey Chamber. When I agreed to an appointment there, I thought—" Well, it doesn't matter what I thought. I was a little too premature. What I want to say now is that, while I have no objection to you, as Clorinde's father, asking me any questions in reason about myself, I feel a delicacy in discussing my private affairs with a perfect stranger." His burning eyes looked me through and through. "I don't understand," he said. "Tell me what you are talking about." I began all over again, telling him exactly what I felt about solicitors and settlements. "Are you well?" he asked sternly. "What have I ever said about settlements or solicitors?" I saw that I was wrong again, and could only stammer something to the effect that a remark of Clorinde's had given me this impression. "What could she have said to convey such an idea? Passes my comprehension," he said gravely. "But she knows nothing. She's a mere child. I have felt from the first, my boy, that your aunt's intention was to benefit you quite as much as my own daughter. Believe me, I shall not attempt to restrict you in any way. I shall be too rejoiced to see you come forth in safety from the Grey Chamber." All the relief I had begun to feel respecting the settlements was poisoned by these last words. Why did he talk of that confounded Grey Chamber as if it were a fiery furnace or a cage of lions? What mystery was there concealed beneath all this, and how, since I was obviously supposed to be thoroughly acquainted with it, could I manage to penetrate the secret of this perplexing appointment? While he had been speaking, the faint, mournful music died away, and looking up, I saw Clorinde, a pale, slight form, standing framed in the archway which connected the two rooms. "Go back to your piano, my child," said the baronet. "Augustus and I have much to talk about, which is not for your ears."
"But why not?" she said. "Oh, why not? Papa, dearest mother, Augustus, I can bear it no longer. I have often felt of late that we are living this strange life under the shadow of some fearful thing which would chase all cheerfulness from any home. More than this I did not seek to know. I dared not ask. But now, when I know that Augustus, whom I love with my whole heart, must shortly face this ghastly presence, you cannot wonder if I seek to learn the real extent of the danger that awaits him. Tell me all. I can bear the worst, for it cannot be more horrible than my own fears."
Lady Catafalque had roused herself and was wringing her long mittened hands and moaning feebly. "Paul," she said, "you must not tell her. It will kill her. She's not strong." Her husband seemed undecided, and I myself began to feel exquisitely uncomfortable. Clorinde's words pointed to something infinitely more terrible than a mere solicitor. "Poor girl," said Sir Paul at last, "it was for your own good that the whole truth has thus been concealed from you. But now, perhaps, the time has come when the truest kindness will be to reveal all. What do you say, Augustus?"
I agree with you," I replied faintly. "She ought to be told."
Precisely, he said. Break it to her, then, the nature of the ordeal which lies before you. It was the very thing which I wanted to be broken to me. I would have given the world to know all about it myself. And so I stared at his gloomy old face with eyes that must have betrayed my helpless dismay. At last I saved myself by suggesting that such a story would come less harshly from a parent's lips. Well, so be it, he said. Chlorine, compose yourself, dearest one. Sit down there, and summon up all your fortitude to hear what I am about to tell you. You must know, then, I think you had better let your mother give you a cup of tea before I begin. It will steady your nerves. During the delay which followed, for Sir Paul did not consider his daughter sufficiently fortified until she had taken at least three cups, I suffered tortures of suspense which I dared not betray. They never thought of offering me any tea, though the merest observer might have noticed how very badly I wanted it. At last the baronet was satisfied, and not without a sort of gloomy enjoyment and a proud relish of the distinction implied in his exceptional affliction, he began his weird and almost incredible tale. "It is now," said he, "some centuries since our ill-fated house was first afflicted with the family curse which still attends it. A certain Humphrey de Catafalque, by his acquaintance with the black art, as it was said, had procured the services of a species of familiar, a dread and supernatural being. For some reason he had conceived a bitter enmity towards his nearest relations, whom he hated with a virulence that not even death could soften. For by a refinement of malice, he bequeathed this baleful thing to his descendants forever as an inalienable heirloom, and to this day it follows the title. And the head of the family for the time being is bound to provide it with a secret apartment under his own roof, but that is not the worst. As each member of our house succeeds to the ancestral rank and honors, he must seek an interview with the curse, as it has been styled for generations, and in that interview it is decided whether the spell is to be broken and the curse depart from us forever, or whether it is to continue its blighting influence and hold yet another life in miserable thraldom.
And are you one of its thralls, then, Papa? Faltered Chlorine.
I am indeed, he said. I failed to quell it, as every catafalque, however brave and resolute, has failed yet. It checks all my accounts, and woe to me if that cold, withering eye discovers the slightest error, even in the pence column. I could not describe the extent of my bondage to you, my daughter, or the humiliation of having to go and tremble monthly before that awful presence. Not even yet, old as I am, have I grown quite accustomed to it.
Never in my wildest imaginings had I anticipated anything one quarter so dreadful as this, but still I clung to the hope that it was impossible to bring me into the affair.
But, Sir Paul, I said, Sir Paul, you mustn't stop there or you'll alarm Chlorine more than there's any need to do. Don't you see? She's got some idea into her head that I have to go through much the same sort of thing. Just explain that to her. I'm not a catafalque, Chlorine, so it can't interfere with me. That is so, isn't it, Sir Paul? Good heavens, sir, don't torture her like this, I cried as he was silent. Speak out.
You mean well, Augustus, he said, but the time for deceiving her has gone by. She must know the worst.
Yes, my poor child, he continued to Chlorine, whose eyes were wide with terror, though I fancy mine were even wider. Unhappily, through our beloved Augustus,
is not a catafalque himself. He has, of his own free will, brought himself within the influence of the curse. And he, too, at the appointed hour, must keep the awful assignation and brave all that the most fiendish malevolence can do to shake his resolution. I could not say a single word. The horror of the idea was altogether too much for me, and I fell back on my chair in a state of speechless collapse. "You see," Sir Paul went on explaining, "it is not only all new baronets, but everyone who would seek an alliance with the females of our race, who must, by the terms of that strange bequest, also undergo this trial. It may be in some degree owing to this necessity that ever since Humphrey de Catafalque's diabolical testament first took effect, every maiden of our house has died a spinster." Here Chlorine hid her face with a low wail. "In 1770, it is true, one solitary suitor was emboldened by love and daring to face the ordeal. He went calmly and resolutely to the chamber where the curse was then lodged. And the next morning, they found him outside the door, a gibbering maniac." I writhed on my chair. "Augustus!" cried Chlorine wildly. "Promise me you will not permit the curse to turn you into a gibbering maniac. I think if I saw you gibber, I should die." I was on the verge of gibbering then. I dared not trust myself to speak. "Nay, Chlorine," said Sir Paul more cheerfully, "there is no cause for alarm. All has been made smooth for Augustus." I began to brighten a little at this. His Aunt Petronia had made a special study of the old world science of incantation, and had undoubtedly succeeded at last in discovering the master word, which, employed according to her directions, would almost certainly break the unhallowed spell. In her compassionate attachment to us, she formed the design of persuading a youth of blameless life and antecedents to present himself as our champion. And the report she had been given of our dear Augustus' irreproachable character led her to select him as a likely instrument. And her confidence in his generosity and courage was indeed well-founded, for he responded at once to the appeal of his departed aunt, and with her instructions for his safeguard, and the consciousness of his virtue as an additional protection, there is hope, my child, strong hope, that, though the struggle may be a long and bitter one, yet Augustus will emerge a victor." I saw very little ground for expecting to emerge as anything of the kind, or for that matter to emerge at all except in installments, for the master word which was to abash the demon was probably inside the packet of instructions, and that was certainly somewhere at the bottom of the sea outside Melbourne, fathoms below the surface. I could bear no more. "It's simply astonishing to me," I said, "that in the 19th century, hardly 6 miles from Charing Cross, you can calmly allow this hideous curse, or whatever you call it, to have things all its own way like this." "What can I do, Augustus?" he asked helplessly. "Do? Anything," I retorted wildly, for I scarcely knew what I said. "Take it out for an airing. It must want an airing by this time. Take it out and lose it, or get both the archbishops to step in and lay it for you. Sell the house, and make the purchaser take it at a valuation with the other fixtures. I certainly would not live under the same roof with it. And I want you to understand one thing. I was never told all this. I have been kept in the dark about it. Of course, I knew there was some kind of curse in the family, but I never dreamed of anything so bad as this. And I never had any intention of being boxed up alone with it either. I shall not go near the Grey Chamber." "Not go near it?" they all cried aghast. "Not on any account," I said, for I felt firmer and easier now that I had taken up this position. "If the curse has any business with me, let it come down and settle it here before you all, in a plain, straightforward manner. Let us go about it in a businesslike way. On second thoughts," I added, fearing lest they should find some means of carrying out this suggestion, "I won't meet it anywhere." "And Why? Why won't you meet it? They asked breathlessly.
Because, I explained desperately, because I'm a materialist.
I had not been previously aware that I had any decided opinions on the question, but I could not stay then to consider the point.
How can I have any dealings with a preposterous, supernatural something which my reason forbids me to believe in? You see my difficulty. It would be inconsistent to begin with and extremely painful to both sides.
No more of this ribaldry, said Sir Paul sternly. It may be terribly remembered against you when the hour comes. Keep a guard over your tongue for all our sakes, and more especially for your own. Recollect that the curse knows all that passes beneath this roof, and do not forget, too, that you are pledged, irrevocably pledged. You must confront the curse.
Only a short hour ago, and I had counted Chlorine's fortune and Chlorine as virtually mine. And now I saw my golden dreams roughly shattered forever. And oh, what a wrench it was to tear myself from them, what it cost me to speak the words that barred my paradise to me forever. But if I wished to avoid confronting the curse, and I did wish this very much, I had no other course. I had no right to pledge myself, I said with quivering lips, under the circumstances.
Why not? They demanded again. What circumstances?
Well, in the first place, I assured them earnestly, I'm a base impostor. I am indeed. I'm not Augustus McFadden at all. My real name is of no consequence, but it's a prettier one than that. As for McFadden, I regret to say, is now no more.
Why on earth? I could not have told the plain truth here has always been a mystery to me. I suppose I had been lying so long that it was difficult to break myself of this occasionally inconvenient trick at so short a notice. But I certainly mixed things up to a hopeless extent. Yes, I continued mournfully, McFadden is dead. I will tell you how he died, if you would care to know. During his voyage here, he fell overboard and was almost instantly appropriated by a gigantic shark, when, as I happened to be present, I enjoyed the melancholy privilege of seeing him pass away. For one brief moment, I beheld him between the jaws of the creature, so pale, but so composed. I refer to McFadden, you understand, not the shark. He threw just one glance up at me, and with a smile, the sad sweetness of which I shall never forget. It was McFadden's smile, I mean, of course, not the shark's. He, courteous and considerate to the last, requested me to break the news and remember him very kindly to you all, and in the same instant, he abruptly vanished within the monster, and I never saw either of them again. Of course, in bringing the shark in at all, I was acting directly contrary to my instructions, but I quite forgot them in my anxiety to escape the acquaintance of the curse of the catafalques.
If this is true, sir, said the baronet haughtily when I had finished, you have indeed deceived us basely.
That, I replied, is what I was endeavoring to bring out. You see, it puts it quite out of my power to meet your family curse. I should not feel justified in intruding upon it. So if you will kindly let someone fetch a fly or a cab in half an hour.
Stop! Cried Chlorine. Augustus, as I will call you still, you must not go like this. If you have stooped to deceit, it was for love of me, and Mr. McFadden is dead. If he had been alive, I should have felt it my duty to allow him an opportunity of winning my affection, but he is lying in his silent tomb, and I have learnt to love you. Stay, then, stay, and brave the curse. We may yet be happy. I saw how foolish I had been not to tell the truth at first, and I hastened to repair this error.
When I described McFadden as dead, I said hoarsely, it was a loose way of putting the facts, because, to be quite accurate, he isn't dead. We found out afterwards that it was another fellow the shark had swallowed, and in fact another shark altogether, so he's alive and now in Melbourne, and when he came to know about the curse, he was too much frightened to come across, and he asked me to call and make his excuses, and I have now done so and will trespass no further on your kindness. If you will tell somebody to bring a vehicle of any sort in a quarter of an hour. Pardon me, said the baronet, but we cannot part in this way. I feared when I first saw you that your resolution might give way under the strain. It is only natural, I admit, but you deceive yourself if you think we cannot see that these extraordinary and utterly contradictory stories are prompted by sudden panic. I quite understand it, Augustus. I cannot blame you, but to allow you to withdraw now would be worse than weakness on my part. The panic will pass. You will forget these fears tomorrow. You must forget them. Remember, you have promised. For your own sake, I shall take care that you do not forfeit that solemn bond, for I dare not let you run the danger of exciting the curse by a deliberate insult. I saw clearly that his conduct was dictated by a deliberate and most repulsive selfishness. He did not entirely believe me, but he was determined that if there was any chance that I, whoever I might be, could free him from his present thraldom, he would not let it escape him. I raved, I protested, I implored. All in vain. They would not believe a single word I said. They positively refused to release me and insisted upon my performing my engagement. And at last, Chlorine and her mother left the room with a little contempt for my unworthiness mingled with their evident compassion, and a little later Sir Paul conducted me to my room and locked me in, till, as he said, I had returned to my senses. What a night I passed! As I tossed sleeplessly from side to side under the canopy of my old-fashioned bedstead, torturing my fevered brain with vain speculations as to the fate the morrow was to bring me, I felt myself perfectly helpless. I saw no way out of it. They seemed bent upon offering me up as a sacrifice to this private Moloch of theirs. The baronet was quite capable of keeping me locked up all the next day and pushing me into the gray chamber to take my chance when the hour came. If I only had some idea what the curse was like to look at, I thought I might not feel quite so afraid of it. The vague and impalpable awfulness of the thing was intolerable, and the very thought of it caused me to fling myself about in an ecstasy of horror. By degrees, however, as daybreak came near, I grew calmer, until at length I arrived at a decision. It seemed evident to me that as I could not avoid my fate, the wisest course was to go forth to meet it with as good a grace as possible. Then should I, by some unfortunate accident, come well out of it, my fortune was insured. But if I went on repudiating my assumed self to the very last, I should surely arouse a suspicion which the most signal rout of the curse would not serve to dispel. And after all, as I began to think, the whole thing had probably been much exaggerated if I could only keep my head and exercise all my powers of cool impudence. I might contrive to hoodwink this formidable relic of medieval days, which must have fallen rather behind the age by this time. It might even turn out to be, although I was hardly sanguine as to this, as big a humbug as I was myself, and we should meet with confident winks, like the two augurs. But at all events, I resolved to see this mysterious affair out, and to trust to my customary good luck to bring me safely through. And so, having found the door unlocked, I came down to breakfast something like my usual self, and set myself to remove the unfavorable impression I had made on the previous night. They did it from consideration for me, but still it was mistaken kindness for them all to leave me entirely to my own thoughts during the whole of the day, for I was driven to mope alone about the gloom-laden building until by dinner time I was very low indeed from nervous depression.
We dined in almost unbroken silence now and then, as Sir Paul saw my hand approaching a decanter. He would open his lips to observe that I should need the clearest head and the firmest nerve ere long, and warn me solemnly against the brown sherry from time to time, too. Chlorine and her mother stole apprehensive glances at me and sighed heavily between every course. I never remember eating a dinner with so little enjoyment. The meal came to an end at last. The ladies rose, and Sir Paul and I were left to brood over the dessert. I fancy both of us felt a delicacy in starting a conversation, and before I could hit upon a safe remark, Lady Catafalque and her daughter returned, dressed to my unspeakable horror, in readiness to go out. Worse than that, even Sir Paul apparently intended to accompany them, for he rose at their entrance. "It is now time for us to bid you a solemn farewell, Augustus," he said in his hollow old voice. "You have 3 hours before you yet, and if you are wise, you will spend them in earnest self-preparation at midnight punctually, for you must not dare to delay. You will go to the Grey Chamber, the way thither you know, and you will find the curse prepared for you. Goodbye, then, brave and devoted boy. Stand firm, and no harm can befall you." "You are going away, all of you?" I cried. They were not what you might call a gay family to sit up with, but even their society was better than my own. "Upon these dread occasions," he explained, "it is absolutely forbidden for any human being but one to remain in the house. All the servants have already left, and we are about to take our departure for a private hotel near the Strand. We shall just have time, if we start at once, to inspect the Sloane Museum on our way thither, which will serve as some distraction from the terrible anxiety we shall be feeling." At this, I believe I positively howled with terror. All my old panic came back with a rush. "Don't leave me all alone with it," I cried. "I shall go mad if you do." Sir Paul simply turned on his heel in silent contempt, and his wife followed him. But Chlorine remained behind for one instant, and somehow, as she gazed at me with a yearning pity in her sad eyes, I thought I had never seen her looking so pretty before. "Augustus," she said, "get up. I suppose I must have been on the floor somewhere. Be a man. Show us we were not mistaken in you. You know I would spare you this if I could, but we are powerless. Oh, be brave, or I shall lose you forever." Her appeal did seem to put a little courage into me, so I staggered up and kissed her slender hand and vowed sincerely to be worthy of her. And then she too passed out, and the heavy hall door slammed behind the three, and the rusty old gate screeched like a banshee as it swung back and closed with a clang. I heard the carriage wheels grind the slush, and the next moment I knew that I was shut up on Christmas Eve in that somber mansion with the curse of the catafalques as my sole companion. I don't think the generous ardor with which Chlorine's last words had inspired me lasted very long, for I caught myself shivering before the clock struck 9, and drawing up a clumsy leathern armchair close to the fire, I piled on the logs and tried to get rid of a certain horrible sensation of internal vacancy which was beginning to afflict me. I tried to look my situation fairly in the face. Whatever reason and common sense had to say about it, there seemed no possible doubt that something of a supernatural order was shut up in that great chamber down the corridor, and also that if I meant to win Chlorine, I must go up and have some kind of interview with it. Once more, I wished I had some definite idea to go upon. What description of being should I find this curse? Would it be aggressively ugly like the bogey of my infancy, or should I see a lank and unsubstantial shape, draped in clinging black, with nothing visible beneath it but a pair of burning hollow eyes and one long, pale, bony hand? Really, I could not decide which would be the more trying of the two. By and by, I began to recollect unwillingly all the frightful stories I had ever read. One in particular came back to me, the adventure of a foreign marshal who, after much industry, succeeded in invoking an evil spirit which came bouncing into the room, shaped like a gigantic ball, with, I think, a hideous face in the middle of it, and would not be got rid of until the horrified marshal had spent hours in hard praying and persistent exorcism. What should I do if the curse was a globular one and came rolling all around the room after me? Then there was another appalling tale I had read in some magazine, a tale of a secret chamber, too, and in some respects a very similar case to my own, for there the heir of some great house had to go in and meet a mysterious aged person with strange eyes and an evil smile who kept attempting to shake hands with him. Nothing should induce me to shake hands with the curse of the catafalques, however apparently friendly I might find it, but it was not very likely to be friendly, for it was one of those mystic powers of darkness which know nearly everything. It would detect me as an impostor directly, and what would become of me? I declare I almost resolved to confess all and sob out my deceit upon its bosom, and the only thing which made me pause was the reflection that probably the curse did not possess a bosom. By this time I had worked myself up to such a pitch of terror that I found it absolutely necessary to brace my nerves, and I did brace them. I emptied all three decanters, but as Sir Paul's cellar was none of the best, the only result was that, while my courage and daring were not perceptibly heightened, I was conscious of feeling exceedingly unwell. Tobacco, no doubt, would have calmed and soothed me, but I did not dare to smoke, for the curse, being old-fashioned, might object to the smell of it, and I was anxious to avoid exciting its prejudices unnecessarily. And so I simply sat in my chair and shook. Every now and then I heard steps on the frosty path outside. Sometimes a rapid tread, as of some happy person bound to scenes of Christmas revelry, and little dreaming of the miserable wretch he was passing, and sometimes the slow, creaking tramp of the Fulham policeman on his beat. What if I called him in and gave the curse into custody, either for putting me in bodily fear, as it was undeniably doing, or for being found on the premises under suspicious circumstances? There was a certain audacity about this means of cutting the knot that fascinated me at first, but still I did not venture to adopt it, thinking it most probable that the stolid constable would decline to interfere as soon as he knew the facts, and even if he did, it would certainly annoy Sir Paul extremely to hear of his family curse spending its Christmas in a police cell, and I felt instinctively that he would consider it a piece of unpardonable bad taste on my part. So 1 hour passed. A few minutes after 10, I heard more footsteps and voices in low consultation, as if a band of men had collected outside of the railings. Could there be any indication without of the horrors these walls contain? But no, the gaunt house front kept its secret too well. They were merely the waits. They saluted me with the old carol, "God rest you, merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay," which should have encouraged me, but it didn't. And they followed that up by a wheezy but pathetic rendering of the mistletoe bough. For a time I did not object to them. While they were scraping and blowing outside, I felt less abandoned and cut off from human help. And then they might arouse softer sentiments in the curse upstairs by their seasonable strains. These things do happen at Christmas sometimes. But their performance was really so infernally bad that it was calculated rather to irritate than subdue any evil spirit, and very soon I rushed to the window and beckoned to them furiously to go away. Unhappily, they thought I was inviting them indoors for refreshment and came round to the gate, where they knocked and rang incessantly for a quarter of an hour. This must have stirred the cursed up quite enough, but when they had gone, there came a man with a barrel organ, which was suffering from some complicated internal disorder, causing it to play its whole repertoire at once in maddening discord. Even the grinder himself seemed dimly aware that his instrument was not doing itself justice, for he would stop occasionally as if to ponder or examine it. But he was evidently a sanguine person and had hopes of bringing it round by a little perseverance. So as Parson's Green was well suited by its quiet for this mode of treatment, he remained there till he must have reduced the curse to a rampant and rabid condition. He went at last. And then the silence that followed began, to my excited fancy, for I certainly saw nothing, to be invaded by strange sounds that echoed about the old house. I heard sharp reports from the furniture, sighing moans from the draughty passages, doors opening and shutting, and worse still, stealthy, padding footsteps, both above and in the ghostly hall outside. I sat there in an ice-cold perspiration until my nerves required more bracing, to effect which I had recourse to the spirit case. After a short time, my fears began to melt away rapidly. What a ridiculous bugbear I was making of this thing, after all. Was I not too hasty in setting it down as ugly and hostile before I had seen it? How did I know it was anything which deserved my horror? Here a gush of sentiment came over me at the thought that it might be that for long centuries the poor corpse had been cruelly misunderstood, that it might be a blessing in disguise. I was so affected by the thought that I resolved to go up at once and wish it a Merry Christmas through the keyhole, just to show that I came in no unfriendly spirit. But would not that seem as if I was afraid of it? I scorned the idea of being afraid. Why, for two straws, I would go straight in and pull its nose for it, if it had a nose. I went out with this object, not very steadily, but before I had reached the top of the dim and misty staircase, I had given up all ideas of defiance, and merely intended to go as far as the corridor by way of a preliminary canter. The coffin-lid door stood open, and I looked apprehensively down the corridor. The grim metal fittings on the massive door of the gray chamber were gleaming with a mysterious pale light. Something between the phenomena obtained by electricity and the peculiar phosphorescence observable in a decayed shellfish. Under the door, I saw the reflection of a sullen red glow. And within I could hear sounds like the roar of a mighty wind, above which peals of fiendish mirth rang out at intervals, and were followed by a hideous, dull clanking. It seemed only too evident the curse was getting up the steam for our interview. I did not stay there long, because I was afraid that it might dart out suddenly and catch me eavesdropping, which would be a hopelessly bad beginning. I got back to the dining room somehow. The fire had taken advantage of my short absence to go out, and I was surprised to find by the light of the fast-dimming lamp that it was 11:45 already. Only 15 more fleeting minutes, and then, unless I gave up Chlorine and her fortune forever, I must go up and knock at that awful door and enter the presence of the frightful mystic, the thing that was roaring and laughing and clanking on the other side. Stupidly, I sat and stared at the clock. In 5 minutes now, I should be beginning my desperate duel with one of the powers of darkness, a thought which gave me sickening qualms. I was clinging to the thought that I had still 2 precious minutes left, perhaps my last moments of safety and sanity, when the lamp expired with a gurgling sob and left me in the dark. I was afraid of sitting there all alone any longer, and besides, if I lingered, the curse might come down and fetch me. The horror of this idea made me resolve to go up at once, especially as scrupulous punctuality might propitiate it. Groping my way to the door, I reached the hall and stood there, swaying under the old stained-glass lantern. And then I made a terrible discovery. I was not in a condition to transact any business. I had disregarded Sir Paul's well-meant warning at dinner. I was not my own master. I was lost. The clock in the adjoining room tolled 12, and from without the distant steeples proclaimed it in faint peals and chimes that it was Christmas morn. My hour had come. Why did I not mount those stairs? I tried again and again, and fell down every time, and at each attempt, I knew the curse would be getting more and more impatient. I was quite 5 minutes late, and yet with all my eagerness to be punctual, I could not get up that staircase. It was a horrible situation, but it was not at its worst even then, for I heard a jarring sound above, as if heavy rusty bolts were being withdrawn. The curse was coming down to see what had become of me. I should have to confess my inability to go upstairs without assistance, and so place myself wholly at its mercy. I made one more desperate effort, and then, upon my word, I don't know how it was exactly, but as I looked wildly about, I caught sight of my hat on the hat rack below. And thoughts that it roused in me proved too strong for resistance. Perhaps it was weak of me, but I venture to think that the very few men in my position would have behaved any better. I renounced my ingenious and elaborate scheme forever. The door, fortunately for me, was neither locked nor bolted, and the next moment I was running for my life along the road to Chelsea, urged on by the fancy that the curse itself was in hot pursuit. For weeks after that, I lay in hiding, starting at every sound. So fearful was I that the outraged curse might track me down at last. All my worldly possessions were at Parson's Green, and I could not bring myself to write or call for them. Nor, indeed, have I seen any of the catafalques since that awful Christmas Eve. I wish to have nothing more to do with them, for I feel naturally they took a cruel advantage of my youth and inexperience, and I shall always resent the deception and constraint to which I so nearly fell a victim. But it occurs to me that those who may have followed my strange story with any curiosity and interest may be slightly disappointed at its conclusion, which I cannot deny is a lame and unsatisfactory one. They expected, no doubt, to be told what the curse's personal appearance is, and how it comports itself in the ghastly gray chamber, what it said to me, what I said to it, and what happened after that. This information, as it will be easily understood, I cannot pretend to give. And for myself, I have long ceased to feel the slightest curiosity on any of these points. But for the benefit of such as are less indifferent, I may suggest that almost any eligible bachelor would easily obtain the opportunities I failed to enjoy by simply calling at the old mansion at Parson's Green and presenting himself to the baronet as a suitor for his daughter's hand. I shall be most happy to allow my name to be used as a reference. Join me next week on Stories from the Shadows for another spine-tingling tale of the unseen and the unknown. Till then, I wouldn't blame you if you leave the lights on.